Hello and welcome to the Turkish History Podcast. Episode 37. The Great Seljuk Empire. Culture. Before we begin, if you have been enjoying this podcast, I'd like to ask you to please subscribe, rate, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get this podcast. It would mean a lot to me and would help more people find the podcast. Thank you for listening. So this is the last in our short series of non-narrative episodes on the Seljuk Empire. And this episode will cover culture in the empire. Following this episode, we will return to the narrative, and we will finally move to Anatolia to cover the beginning of Turkish migration into what is now the homeland of the Turks. Now, talking about Seljuk culture is actually quite difficult. First of all, what do we mean when we say culture? It is such a nebulous term, but what I mean by it is both the arts and sciences and the way people live their lives day to day. And that makes it exceptionally difficult to discuss culture in the Seljuk era, because, as I said in the episode on the economy, we know basically nothing about how the vast bulk of the population lived. 80 to 90% of the population were peasants or nomadic herdsmen, who the Islamic histories just don't focus on at all. And even of the remaining 10 to 20% of the population, the sources really just focus on the truly elite. The courts, the caliphs, the bureaucrats, the scribes, the high-ranking nobles, and so on. So our view into culture is actually incredibly limited. We only can see how the very top sliver of society lived. Imagine if all that came down to us about our contemporary societies was how presidents, prime ministers, celebrities, and billionaires lived, and that was all you had to go on. That's kind of the situation we're in here. So really, this episode is going to focus on the culture of the Seljuk court and the culture of this truly elite world, which, though a very, very narrow view of Seljuk society, is really all we have. And though it is not representative, it is still very important, because this elite culture was responsible for creation of what we would call high culture, and because the court culture of the Seljuk dynasty would be brought into Anatolia. This court culture is going to basically be the backdrop against which the high drama of the political events of the Seljuk Sultanate of Rum is going to play out. And it will also, of course, greatly influence the beyliks of Anatolia after the fall of the Sultanate, continuing and evolving along the way into the court culture of the Ottoman Empire. Additionally, some of the most important parts of the Seljuk legacy are these high cultural products, including the works of the famous Al-Ghazali and Omar Khayyam. So it is still worth delving into, even if you should remember that it is an incredibly limited view. Now to begin, it is important to remember where Seljuk court life took place. As we discussed in our episodes on the state and the military, the Seljuk court was basically mobile. Now this wasn't always the case. Melik Shah, for example, seems to have spent a great deal of time in palaces in Esfahan and Baghdad. But in general, the Seljuk court tended to live basically a nomadic or semi-nomadic life. This was an evolution from the nomadic life of a steppe warlord, with the tents becoming progressively more luxurious and the mobile camp ever more grand. Ultimately, it evolved into the muasker, the place of the soldiers, a massive, mobile city that traversed the great empire. When camped, the muasker could be up to 2 farsangs a side, that is about 12 kilometers a side, so truly massive. Often, even when the court stopped at a city, the sultans would continue to live in the muasker outside its gates. Though, as I said, this wasn't always true, and sometimes some sultans would spend an extended period of time in the palaces of the cities they visited. However, we shouldn't overstate this, and the great historian of the Seljuk Empire, A.C.S. Peacock, has in fact posited that most of the palaces built by the Seljuk princes and sultans may have been essentially ceremonial buildings, built to glorify the ruler, and in actuality inhabited only for brief periods of time to perform important ceremonies. So in general, I think we should conceptualize court life taking place not in grand palaces, but in the mobile city of the Muasker. Now, the Muasker was essentially a semi-public and semi-private space, and we should not imagine there being strict divisions between personal life and public life like we have today. Today, we conceptualize of the workplace and the home as two entirely separate spheres, and we place great importance on the division between them, what we today call work-life balance. This was emphatically not the way the Seljuk court worked. There was, in essence, no difference between the two. All of life played out in public, and in many ways, work and pleasure occupied the same space and time. Maybe a good way for us modern people to think about this is sort of like every meal being a working lunch, every sports outing a work event, every party an office party. Here, the life of the court revolved around the sultan and the business of the sultan. That is, government pervaded everything. Now, as I said in the episode on the state, surrounding the sultan were the courtiers, the khas. This was a Persian institution that had been grafted onto the traditional steppe court of nomadic aristocrats. So imagine both a bunch of Turkish steppe nomads and a bunch of Persian and Arab courtiers, people who would have served a caliph or a shah in an earlier era. This body of courtiers, the khas, was rigidly hierarchical. Everyone's place in the pecking order was determined fundamentally by physical closeness to the person of the sultan. Nizam-ul-Mulk writes, "Established members of the khas stand near the throne, such as the sword-bearer, the wine-bearer, and the like. If someone else wants to stand among them, the chamberlain keeps him away, and likewise, if an unsuitable person stands among the groups, the chamberlain will cry out and not allow it." Interestingly, Nizam-ul-Mulk seems to have tried to enforce a division between the companions of the sultan, called Nadims, and the bureaucracy. This was likely part of him trying to pry the business of government away from the Turkish chieftains and aristocrats he detested. But while this may have partially worked for Nizam-ul-Mulk during al-Dawla al-Nizamiya, it wasn't something that seems to have been otherwise successful. And indeed, this very act of trying to limit the power and the influence of the sultan's companions was in fact part of the very normal jostling for power among the members of the khas. The extremely rigid hierarchy of the khas, derived from closeness to the sultan, would then be demonstrated in a bewildering array of titles. Each title was ranked in order, but it was complicated by the fact that courtiers could carry any number of titles and ranks, which of course was connected to the overlapping and messy nature of Seljuk administration, where bureaucrats could serve on multiple diwans and have multiple offices. Theoretically, the titles were divided between military and civilian, with civilians taking ul-mulk or al-din at the end of their string of titles, and the military taking al-dawla. However, this division seems not to have been particularly strictly kept, again, because of the overlapping and messy nature of the Seljuk state. Nizam-ul-Mulk, for example, complains bitterly about Turks using ul-mulk and al-din in their titles. But the very fact of his sensitivity about this shows the great importance the khas put on titles. Another key marker of rank was the nauba, or the beating of a drum, a practice taken from the palaces of the caliphs. The nauba was essentially a drum beaten to a certain tempo upon the arrival of the person in question. Think of it like perpetual walk-on music. There were reportedly 5 different beats, each of which corresponded to a different rank. So these were the sort of people who played out the life of the court and partook in the court culture. A mixed body of Turkish military men and Persian and Arab civilian men. But what was this court life like? What did these people actually get up to every day? Well, part of court life, the court culture, of course, involved ceremonies. Everywhere in the medieval world, from Europe to the Muslim world to India to China, ceremonies were of great importance. Indeed, of an importance that we modern people can find hard to understand. For us, ceremonies are mostly tedious things you have to endure. Think of sitting there playing on your phone as you wait to pick up your diploma, or stifling a yawn in your cousin's interminable wedding. But in the medieval world, ceremonies were a critical part of how the state demonstrated its power and attempted to enforce its writ. In an age without mass media, planes, trains, or automobiles, the only way the person of the sultan appeared before the local nobility in any given area was through his name being imprinted on coins, or read in the khutbah, or through the temporary visit of his itinerant court. This meant that the presentation of the sultan to the local nobility and the ceremonies enforcing his supremacy over them and their loyalty to him were of extreme importance. Now, there were a great number of ceremonies in the Seljuk court, and typically, these ceremonies either drew upon or were imitations of Abbasid ceremonies or more ancient pre-Islamic Iranian ceremonies. Wherever they went, the sultans would perform the traditional Abbasid practice of holding a daily audience with their diwan, where notables would receive royal favor, and where petitioners could arrive, prostrate themselves, and present their grievances or requests to the sovereign. Part of these ceremonies often involved the granting of clothing to those in favor, following ancient, pre-Islamic Persian customs that probably had their origins in even older, ancient Mesopotamian rituals. This grant of clothing from the ruler, often after he had ceremonially donned it and then removed it to grant to his favored nobles, is recorded ad infinitum in the sources. The most important ceremonies were, of course, accession ceremonies or the appointment of an heir. Though, as we have seen, naming an heir itself was actually not that effective given the nature of the Turkish rules of succession. One of the best descriptions of Seljuk court ceremonies comes from Ibn al-Athir, recounting the appointment of Melik Shah as Alparslan's heir in a ceremony drawing heavily on pre-Islamic Persian models. He wrote, "Alparslan this year left Marv to go to Rai Khan, and camped outside with several emirs of his state. He made them give pledges and understanding to his son Melik Shah that he should be sultan after him. He placed him on a mount and walked before him, carrying the saddle cloth. The sultan bestowed robes on all of the emirs and commanded that the khutbah be pronounced in Melik Shah's name in all of the lands over which he ruled." Interestingly, other ceremonies seem to have included pre-Islamic Zoroastrian holidays. In the East, at least, the court celebrated the great Zoroastrian feast of Sada and Meregan, and Melik Shah ordered the lighting of candles in the middle of the night in accordance with the Zoroastrian ritual of Sadak. There must also have been ceremonies that drew upon Turkish steppe tradition, but as our Persian authors don't really care about these, we know very little about them. However, one Turkish ceremony that we do see attested to in the sources is the traditional yargı, or tribunal, for Turkish nobles accused of wrongdoing. These tribunals would take place in front of the sultan, and though sometimes Islamic scholars would attend to provide their opinions on what the Sharia would say, they often did not. And authority ultimately rested not with a qadi applying Islamic law, but with the sultan, in his capacity as a steppe warlord, applying the law of the steppe, the yasa. The goings-on of these tribunals were often secret, and you kind of get the impression that the Persian and Arab courtiers were often not invited, that these sort of trials were of Turkish nobles under their own laws, and the punishments, be it death or humiliation or exile, were carried out summarily and often in secret, in front of only the Turkish nobles close to the Sultan, hidden from the Arab and Persian courtiers. But these ceremonies only took up a very small part of the court's time. The other great passions were naturally eating, drinking, hunting, and playing polo. Indeed, the Kabusname cautions rulers, "The week has 7 days. Go hunting 2 days. 2 or 3 days occupy yourself with drinking, and 1 day deal with affairs of state." So quite the work week. Honestly, it sounds pretty ideal to most of us, I would imagine. But we should remember that because of the lack of a divide between personal time and professional time, even feasts, hunting, and polo matches were in essence political and professional events for the court. Hunting and polo were the principal physical activities of the Sultan and his retinue, two activities that allowed the Sultan to demonstrate his proficiency with warlike skills: riding, shooting, strategy, and physical toughness. Some sultans, including Melik Shah, kept hunting journals recording how much and what game they caught. Going off of these, it seems that hunting took up a very large percentage of the sultan's time. As noted in the narrative, it was while on a hunting trip that Melik Shah was assassinated, and his hunting journal reportedly recorded some astronomical hunts, including one in which he killed 70 gazelles. Sibt ibn al-Jawzi reports that Melik Shah killed 4,000 to 10,000 gazelles on another trip. Another later Seljuk sultan was said to have had over 400 hunting dogs. And all of this implies hunting was incredibly important to the sultans. Now, we don't have a lot of sources on the manner of hunting, but based on other testimonials of medieval Islamic and Central Asian hunting practices, it seems likely that the sultan and his nobles hunted in a group. They spread out and encircled a certain area and drove all of the animals within that area inwards over the course of a day, ultimately resulting in a huge herd of animals being enclosed in a circle of steppe riders, where they would then be shot from horseback. The other great physical activity was polo. Likely invented in Central Asia, polo is of course a game played on horseback. Two teams of riders armed with long mallets or clubs, who ride across a field, fighting over and hitting a ball either into a goal or into a certain area. Kind of like football, but with horses and clubs. The rules of the game were not as defined then as now, and we don't know how many of the specifics of the game worked, but the game involved a great deal of strategy and could be quite violent. Rival team members could ride up to each other, jostle, and push their opponents down as they chased the ball. So again, a sport that showed off horsemanship, strategy, and physical toughness, all qualities respected and required in a Turkish sultan, or indeed a khan. Feasting also seems to have taken up a large part of the court's time, and there are indications that the amount of food consumed was truly massive. Reportedly, the Turkmen of Balkh were required to provide the later Seljuk sultan Sanjar with 24,000 sheep a year for the sultan's tables. And despite being held by Muslims, these feasts flowed with wine and seemed to have gotten quite rowdy, with musicians, dancing girls, jesters, singing, and carousing. In a very interesting source, the Rahat al-Sudur, written to provide a guide to the Anatolian sultans of Rum as to the proper court etiquette of the great Seljuks, the author writes extensively about drinking and how to drink. There have even been discovered small statues made of Seljuk sultans holding wine cups, likely products of the court itself. And the historian Nishapuri writes of the later Seljuk sultan Masud's stay in Baghdad that the sultan resided in Baghdad that winter, enthusiastically partaking of pleasure and satisfying his desires, impassioned by the bringing of wine jars, acquiring singing girls, having clowns brought into his presence, and sending men of virtue away. Indeed, Nizam-ul-Mulk even includes a passage in his Siyasetname advising courtiers to check back in with the sultan to confirm orders he gave when he was drunk, which of course implies that sultans routinely gave orders when they were drunk at feasts. Again, a sign of the way that politics and work permeated life for the court and the sultan. And while heavy partying might not have been the norm all the time, we should definitely imagine that most of these feasts were quite rowdy. As part of this generally libertine attitude to having fun, it is also worth noting that the Seljuk court was quite accepting of homosexual activity. But this was not really like the homosexual relationships between equals that are common today. Instead, homosexual activity was mostly between powerful men and young Turkish slaves, men intended for the Mamluk armies, but who then caught the eye of a sultan or a courtier. Often, the sources use the word gulam instead of Mamluk for the slaves destined for sexual exploitation instead of for the armies. The Seljuk Sultan Sanjar was reportedly quite taken with a young Turkish slave named Kaymaz. The historian Isfahani writes of a certain drinking party that the Sultan had. His eye was on the slave's eye, his hand on his hand. And unsurprisingly, these relationships could be quite exploitative. The historian Bundari reports of one sultan that, when he found a gulam beautiful, he would castrate him to prolong his beardless looks. This sort of abusive behavior ultimately led to this particular sultan getting assassinated by his very own gulam sex slaves. But sometimes, the relationship would be less exploitative. Famously, Mahmud of Ghazna basically fell in love with his Turkish slave Ayaz and treated him quite well, with their love kind of becoming something like a homosexual medieval Islamic Tristan and Isolde. It was retold in various poems and stories, even some written quite recently. Nevertheless, we should not forget that no matter how well the slave might be treated, you really cannot call these relationships equal, and sexual exploitation sort of underlay all of them. Also noteworthy was the more prominent role of women in the Seljuk court. This was derived from the relatively more open and equal relation between the sexes in Turkish steppe society. Emphasis on the relatively there. The traditional Perso-Islamic ideal for women, at least elite women, was to have them be separated off in a harem. The word harem in English is, of course, derived from the Arabic haram, meaning forbidden, and denotes the fact that these areas were forbidden to men who were not the husband or master of the women contained therein. And the harem certainly existed. Indeed, some sources reference Seljuk sultans spending an inordinate amount of time in their harem. The later Seljuk sultan Mahmud was even reported to have become ill from how much time he spent involved in amorous activities in his harem. Some harems could be quite vast, with powerful sultans and viziers essentially acquiring hundreds of women. The higher-ranking women would have been noble women, who may have had recourse if they were treated poorly. See, for example, Melikshah pulling his daughter out of the caliph's harem after she was mistreated. But sexual slaves acquired in conquest would also have been found in a Seljuk harem, and they probably had basically no recourse against their owner and master. Of course, we don't really know how the women involved felt about this, and I think we should never forget that there was certainly a great deal of sexual violence involved, particularly for those who had been taken in slavery. But while the harem certainly existed in the Seljuk court, elite life was not homosocial as seems to have been the ideal in non-Turkish Islamic states. Seljuk women were emphatically not confined to these spaces. In addition to the plethora of dancing girls, musicians, singers, actresses, and prostitutes who would perform and entertain the men, elite women also played a role in Seljuk court life. This was part of the Turkish cultural tradition at court, and we of course see Persians like Nizam-ul-Mulk relentlessly rail against the presence of these women, seeing it as a barbarian custom and as infringing on their own power. We don't know exactly how elite women behaved at the great feasts and other events of court, but we know that some elite women would have been deeply involved in politics and politically powerful. Some would even come to command armies, most famously Terken Khatun, who we discussed in the narrative. Tuchel also routinely included his wife Altın Can in his councils, and Sipt Ibn al-Jawzi calls her wise, prudent, and decisive, and further says, the Sultan used to listen to her, obeyed her, and referred affairs back to her for consideration. If you'll recall from the narrative, Altın Can was also involved in intrigues at court between Tuchel and the Caliph, and in order to do this, she must have been deeply involved in the semi-public, semi-private life of the court. It also seems that elite Seljuk women had access to their own funds. We have records of them patronizing madrasas and mosques and holding iktafifs, all activities not usually undertaken by women in the Islamic world. Indeed, to build their own webs of patronage, as Terkan Khatun or Altın Can did, they must have had access to wealth of their own. This is a further sign of the power and influence of at least some of the elite Seljuk women and of the public role women had in the Seljuk court. In short, it is apparent from the sources, and in particular, how much the Persian authors complain about it, that Seljuk women played a much, much more public role than was typical for women in Islamic societies. Now, as I said, this more prominent role for women was derived ultimately from the influence of Turkish culture in the Seljuk court, which is a good segue into the role of Turkish culture versus Perso-Islamic culture at court. Now, we should never forget that our Persian authors always try to play down Turkish culture. They always want to make the Seljuk state and court look more Persian. This, of course, makes it hard for us to see the Turkish elements of court culture, as our authors are heavily incentivized to discount them, and they are our only window into what life was like. Yet despite this, it is nevertheless clear that court and court culture remained deeply Turkish in many ways. Indeed, the prominent role of women at court is one of the key indicators of the survival of Turkish culture. This prominence was detested by the Persian Arab authors and shows a real survival of the steppe world's sexual mores. Related to this was the continuation of Turkish marriage traditions, in particular, levirate marriage. Now, levirate marriage is the tradition that a man marries his brother's widows upon his brother's death. This was abhorred by Islam and is forbidden under the Sharia, but it was a long-standing Turkish practice from the steppe world and continued to be practiced by the Seljuk court. And it seems that, in general, marriages were conducted in accordance with Turkish traditions. Sipt Ibn al-Jawzi even mentions that when Melik Shah's daughter married the caliph, 50,000 dinars for the provision of a wet nurse were included in the dowry, which he says is the custom of the Turks in arranging marriages. Additionally, our authors note that princes of the House of Seljuk and Turkish aristocrats continued to wear mustaches in the Turkish tradition. Alparslan's mustache was so long that he reportedly tied it behind his neck. And we also see references to sultans dressing in the Turkmen dress. Turkish music and cuisine also continued, and as we have discussed in our episode on the state, there were several Turkish institutions of state, most importantly, the Atabeys and the Office of Tuchel Writer. But above all, the most important thing is that the language of the court remained Turkish. Yes, Persian would have been spoken by the non-Turkish courtiers, and would have had an important role in poetry and even in aspects of civil administration. Arabic was, of course, the language of religion. But the day-to-day language of the court, the language of power, was Turkish. Tuchel, of course, didn't even speak Persian or Arabic, but even after him, while sultans and Turkish nobles certainly learned the quote-unquote civilized languages of Persian and Arabic, they continued to speak Turkish among themselves. Indeed, under the reign of Melik Shah, Turkish appears to have even been committed to writing on occasion, the very beginning of written Turkish in the Muslim world. It even appears that non-Turks began to learn the language as a way to ingratiate themselves to the court and advance their careers. Mahmud Kashgari enjoined people to learn the language of the Turks, for their reign will be long. And he stated that there is no better way to approach them than by speaking their own tongue, thereby bending their ear and inclining their heart. But though Turkish was the language of power, it was not the language of high culture. Indeed, it was during the Seljuk era that Persian really came to eclipse Arabic as the language of culture among the educated classes, though Arabic, of course, remained the language of religion, and there were still, of course, cultural works produced in the language. This was a process that had been going on since the Abbasid Revolution, but the arrival of the Seljuks from the east accelerated it. As we discussed in our episode on the state, the Seljuks brought with them to the west a whole class of Khorasani courtiers, men who were much more comfortable with Persian than Arabic. The arrival of the Easterners in Iraq, men from the deeply Persian world, basically sealed the ascendancy of Persian. Tellingly, authors who would generally write in Arabic for general consumption would write in Persian when addressing a court audience. And it would be in the Persian language that the great cultural production of the Seljuk Empire would take place. Now, the Seljuk courts, of course, patronized a wide variety of cultural works and the sciences. And before we get to the literary work, I'd like to discuss some of the scientific advances of the period. In the realm of science, the Seljuks were great patrons of astronomy and medicine, as well as engineering and architecture. Melik Shah was a great admirer of architecture, and apparently even fancied himself something of an amateur architect. Great palaces and mosques were constructed under his reign, though unfortunately, very little has survived to the present day. Indeed, most of the Seljuk architectural work surviving today actually dates from after the collapse of the Great Seljuks, when a veritable architectural and artistic explosion took place in the successor states. We will cover the Anatolian part of this cultural flowering in due course, but if you are interested in this later Seljuk architecture, I would highly encourage you to take a trip to Mardin and Midyat in modern-day Turkey, where the best examples of this type of architecture survive. At the intersection of architecture and astronomy, Melik Shah ordered the construction of a great observatory in Esfahan. Befitting a ruling family from the steppes, where astrology and divination were of great importance and where Khans routinely claimed a spiritual connection to the stars, astronomy and astrology were of great interest to the Seljuk court. Advances in telescope technology and the observations of the heavens were made at the Seljuk observatories, and many great works on astronomy, astrology, and meteorology were written. One of the most important works of astronomy, Zici Sanjari, was commissioned by the Seljuk Sultan Sanjar, and then eventually translated into Greek and Latin and brought into the West, where it would eventually come to sit on the bookshelves of Galileo and Leonardo da Vinci. Most importantly, as we will discuss in detail later in this episode, it was under Melik Shah that the Jalali calendar was created. The Jalali calendar takes its name from Melik Shah's laqab, or honorific, Jalal al-Dawla, and is also sometimes simply called Melik Shah's calendar. When it comes to literature, poetry and philosophy were the great literary passions of the Seljuks. Interestingly, the Seljuk dynasty seems to have been largely uninterested in secular history written in prose, and most of what comes down to us is either anecdotes in the mirrors for princes, that is, political treatises and rulership manuals for governing, or from later historians not patronized by the court itself. Instead, great works of poetry and philosophy were written, some of whose words and thoughts come down to us in the present day. And I'd like to dive in detail into some of them so we can get a sense of the continuing cultural legacy of the great Seljuk Empire. And so today, we are going to end the episode by discussing the life and works of two of the towering cultural figures who lived in the Seljuk Empire, one of whom is today extremely controversial and one who is basically universally revered, Al-Ghazali and Omar Khayyam. So to start with the controversial one, Al-Ghazali. Abu Hamid Muhammad ibn Muhammad at-Tusi Al-Ghazali was a Persian born in the city of Tus near Nishapur in Iran in the year 1058. In other words, he was born into what was essentially the heartland of the Seljuk Empire in the last years of Tughril's reign, after Tuchel had been declared king of East and West and the Abbasid caliphs had been freed from their captivity by the Shia Buyids. He came of age as the Seljuk dynasty entrenched its power over Iran and Iraq, and crucially, took upon itself the mantle of upholder and protector of Sunni orthodoxy. As we discussed in our last couple episodes, this led to a Sunni revivalism and the ordering and homogenization of Sunni practices across the empire. This would be the background to al-Ghazali's career, and indeed what his career would contribute to. Al-Ghazali was born into a family of Deccans, the Iranian gentry, though according to some sources, his family had fallen on hard times by the time of his birth. Al-Ghazali began his education by studying Islamic law and philosophy under a local jurist in Tus, and was also inducted into the Naqshbandi order of Sufi mystics. Recognizing his keen intellect and obvious talent, when he was in his late teens, his teacher sent him off to study in Nishapur, under the distinguished Shafi scholar Al-Juwaini. During his time in Nishapur, Al-Ghazali apparently came to the attention of his fellow Khorasani Persian, the elderly Grand Vizier Nizam-ul-Mulk. And upon Al-Juwaini's death in 1085, the now 25-year-old Al-Ghazali left Nishapur and joined Nizam-ul-Mulk's retinue, likely in Esfahan. His genius and deep knowledge of the Sharia and Islamic philosophy were recognized by basically everyone, and Nizam-ul-Mulk would come to bestow upon the young man the title Brilliance of the Religion. Eventually, Nizam-ul-Mulk would appoint al-Ghazali to be the head of the Nizamiya Madrasa that Nizam-ul-Mulk had set up in Baghdad when the young man was only 33 years old. An incredibly prestigious achievement for a man so young, especially given that al-Ghazali was a Shafi and not a Hanafi, which, remember, was the preferred school of the Seljuk court. Nizam-ul-Mulk would then shortly be assassinated and the state would fall into chaos. Al-Ghazali remained on in Baghdad as the head of the Nizamiya Madrasa while the civil war raged in the empire until 1095. At that point, he appears to have had a crisis of faith, ultimately leaving his prestigious post in Baghdad and traveling back to his hometown of Tus. There, he declined all public scholarly roles offered to him and instead lived in seclusion, writing and working by himself. In time, al-Ghazali would build a private madrasa and Sufi lodge, in which he would entertain visitors and teach small private lectures, expounding the ideas he had developed since his crisis of faith. Now, al-Ghazali published a variety of works on a variety of subjects. He was a great scholar of the Shafi school of Islam and the Naqshbandi order of Sufi mystics. Al-Ghazali wrote widely on both subjects, and his condensed summary and commentary of Shafi jurisprudence remains one of the most important works in Shafi legal theory. His work, On the Alchemy of Happiness, is a great defense of Sufi mysticism, and an argument for coexistence between legalistic or orthodox forms of Islamic practice and spiritual and mystical forms of belief. But above all, al-Ghazali is famous and today despised in many quarters for his work on Ash'ari philosophy, and in particular, what is widely considered to be his magnum opus, The Incoherence of the Philosophers, a work so important to Islamic philosophy that it remains at the heart of debates among Islamic theologians and philosophers to this very day, and it is so widely read and known that it is simply called The Incoherence. To understand the incoherence and its arguments, we need to zoom out a bit and look at both the schools of Islamic philosophy and what was happening in the Seljuk Empire during al-Ghazali's life. Basically, starting during the Umayyad and then the Abbasid caliphates, most Islamic philosophers were deeply influenced by Greek philosophy, and a particular school of Islamic theology and philosophy arose called Mutazilism. Mutazilis are in particular influenced by Plato and Aristotle, and they developed a philosophy based on a deep belief in both free will and in the use of reason in understanding religious scriptures and religious law. Essentially, Mutazilis approached the Quran and the Hadith with the tools of Greek philosophy, and then took this tradition and they just ran with it, establishing their own philosophical school of thought. The most famous Islamic scholars of the Golden Age of Islam were Mu'tazilis, including Ibn Sina, known as Avicenna in the West, and Al-Farabi, known as Al-Farabius in the West. And the Mu'tazilis basically saw philosophy as being supreme. In a sense, they believed that there were natural laws of the universe that existed outside of religion, or that religion merely reflects. Al-Farabi famously argued that religions, including Islam, were multiple because people were not capable of understanding the true essence of philosophy, the great philosophic tradition stretching from the ancient Greeks through the Romans and the Persians down to the Islamic philosophers such as himself. Taken to its extreme, that religion was an imitation of philosophy. The other great school, at first, was Atharism, a form of textual literism. Atharis argued that God is so completely beyond any human understanding that we cannot use our meager human tools in trying to decipher the will of Allah. And therefore, you should read only the plain textual meaning of the Quran and the Hadith. That what we call reason is a product of human limitation. That our minds are to God's mind what an ant's mind is to ours. And that it is therefore pointless to question or even really interrogate his word. But such an approach was never going to win out against Mu'tazilism. I mean, it has no answers to seeming inconsistencies in the religious texts. It has nothing to say when the text has no clear meaning. It really has no answers to any philosophical questions beyond shrugging your shoulders and saying God knows best. So a third school arose, the school to which Al-Ghazali belonged. The Ash'ari school, in essence, a middle way between Atharism and Mu'tazilism. The Ash'aris basically believe that yes, of course we need to use reason when we approach the text. Yes, of course there is a role for philosophy and thought. But behind everything is Allah. Religion is not merely an imitation or a reflection of some higher philosophical truth that exists outside of the creation of God. Indeed, there are no natural laws that exist outside of God's will. And it was Al-Ghazali who would author the takedown of Mu'tazilism that would in essence win the day. In a 20-point thesis, he methodically broke down Mu'tazili theories, arguing persuasively, at least persuasively for a religious medieval audience, of the correctness of the Ash'ari position. Now, I'm not going to go into the details of the work, because it is incredibly long and complicated and requires a real understanding and love of philosophy that I frankly don't have, but Al-Ghazali's basic premise was that the philosophers, the Mu'tazilis, were completely incoherent because their theories contradicted basic Islamic principles, and furthermore, that their ideas contained their own internal logical inconsistencies. And Al-Ghazali's work was incredibly persuasive. So persuasive that he basically won the war, and Ash'arism is today the primary school of Sunni Islamic philosophy. In large part, this was because of the Sunni revivalism sponsored by the Seljuk court. As they promoted themselves as the restorers of Sunni orthodoxy, the Seljuks expanded and entrenched the power of the Sunni religious establishment, the ulema. They also built madrasas just all over the place. Madrasas churning out more ulema members. And as Sunni practice became homogenized and entrenched in the Sunni revivalism, of course Al-Ghazali's thinking won out among this invigorated class of religious scholars. Naturally, they wanted to have the power and authority, not defer to what some fancy philosopher thinks up next. This has been incredibly controversial to this very day. Because some modern scholars believe that this victory by Al-Ghazali shut down the philosophical school of thought that had given birth to the great intellectual triumphs of the Golden Age of Islam. Some go further to say that it was due to this book, The Incoherence, that Muslim scientific achievement was eventually overtaken by the Europeans. Indeed, you find some popular figures today making these arguments in the most annoying and inaccurate way possible. But I would note that the incoherence was not the end of the debate. The great Andalusian Mu'tazili scholar Ibn Rushd called Averroes in the West, wrote a rebuttal of al-Ghazali called The Incoherence of the Incoherence, which itself was quite persuasive, though it was largely panned in the medieval Muslim world at the time. And Mu'tazilism didn't die out. Twelver Shia largely follow a Mu'tazili philosophy to this day. Indeed, the so-called death of the Golden Age of Islam is a bit overblown. It's not that scholarship in the Muslim world ended, it just shifted. It moved out of Baghdad, and indeed out of the Arabic language, aside from Andalusia, and into the Persian language and into Central Asia. And I'd argue that the collapse of serious scholarship in Egypt, Iraq, and Syria has less to do with one very influential book than it has to do with the invasions of the Crusaders and the Mongols, the Mongol sack of Baghdad, and the general ruin caused by the Seljuk Wars of Succession. And I'd also note that arguing that a very intellectual book caused an intellectual decline is a bit weird. The ideas of al-Ghazali were part of a broader philosophical debate, a very intellectual pursuit, and the debate itself didn't end with his book. Eventually, al-Ghazali died in Tus in December 1113, at the age of 53. He was mourned widely, and has been called the reviver of Islam in his age. One Shafi scholar went so far as to say, if there had been a prophet after Muhammad, al-Ghazali would have been the man. And his works deeply influenced thinkers as different as Ibn Rushd, David Hume, René Descartes, Jalal ad-Din al-Suyuti, and Thomas Aquinas. Quite the intellectual legacy for a guy some decry as the man who ended the Golden Age of Islam. And now, to wrap up, we'll finish with a man who is not controversial, but instead basically universally beloved in both the Muslim world and in the West. Arguably the greatest cultural product of the Seljuk Empire, the famous mathematician, astronomer, thinker, and poet Omar Khayyam. Omar Khayyam was born in Nishapur in 1048, so 10 years after Tughril first conquered the city and just as he was conquering the rest of Iran. Because his family name means tentmaker, most scholars believe that he was born into a bourgeois family of tentmakers, though we can't be sure. We don't know much about his childhood, but his family must have been wealthy and secure enough to send him to be educated. Once his education began, Omar Khayyam's intelligence was quickly recognized, and he was quickly sent off to be educated by the greatest teacher in the city. Even in his teens, he excelled in astronomy and mathematics, and acquired a reputation for genius. In 1068, at the age of 20, the precocious young man left Nishapur for Bukhara in order to study in its fantastic library. 2 years later, he moved further east, coming to Samarkand in the Karakhanate Khanate, home not only to one of the best libraries in the medieval world, but to great observatories and a community of renowned astronomers and mathematicians. And it was here in Samarkand, in the early 1070s, that Omar Khayyam really began the work that he was most famous for during his lifetime. See, even though today we know him best for his poetry, during his life and for like the 500 or so years after it, Omar Khayyam was actually most famous as a mathematician and an astronomer. And it was now that he began writing his famous treatise on algebra, a work of mathematics that would sit on the desks of mathematicians across the world for centuries to come. Upon arriving in Samarkand, the young Omar Khayyam's genius was recognized by the Karakhanate court, and he quickly became a favorite of the Khan. Thus began his royal patronage, which would come to be his main source of income for the rest of his life. The historian Baihaqi records that the Khan showed him the greatest honor, so much so that he would seat Khayyam next to him on the throne. But then, of course, as we discussed in the narrative, the Karakhanate Khanate was conquered by Melik Shah in 1074, a mere 4 years after Omar Khayyam's arrival in the city when he was about 26 years old. And so great was this young man's reputation that Nizam-ul-Mulk recommended that Sultan Melik Shah meet him, and so Omar Khayyam traveled to Marv, meeting the great Seljuk Sultan in 1075. Greatly impressed by Omar Khayyam, who was just a couple years older than him, and eager to import into the heartland of his empire the greatness of recently conquered Samarkand, Malik Shah brought Omar Khayyam into his service. Khayyam thus came to Esfahan and was trusted by Malik Shah with setting up an observatory like the one that Malik Shah had seen in Samarkand. And as I briefly mentioned earlier, Malik Shah then tasked Omar Khayyam with leading a commission of astronomers to develop a new calendar, what would come to be called the Jalali calendar. The Jalali calendar designed by Omar Khayyam and his commission is an exceptionally accurate solar calendar. Each year starts on the spring equinox, with time computed by precisely timing solar movement into the 12 zodiac regions. This means that as opposed to the now widespread Gregorian calendar, each year is astronomically accurate at its start. The Jalali calendar is by some metrics even more accurate than the Gregorian calendar, despite having been designed about 500 years earlier. More importantly, it was a much more effective calendar than the traditional Islamic lunar calendar for administrative purposes. As all Muslims know, the traditional Islamic lunar calendar moves forward by about 11 to 12 days each year. This means that months do not correspond to the seasons. By creating a solar calendar, where the months would fall in the same time with respect to the seasons, the collection of taxes and state budgeting in an agricultural society was made immeasurably easier. Planting and harvesting and the collection of taxes would happen at the same time every year. Ultimately, the Jalali calendar would evolve into the various solar Hijri calendars, solar calendars that date time from Muhammad's Hijra to Medina, in place of the classic lunar Hijri calendar. These include those calendars still in use in Iran and Afghanistan to this day, and the Jalali calendar also influenced the creation of the now defunct Ottoman Rumi calendar. In addition to the calendar, it was also in Esfahan that Omar Khayyam began publishing his great works on mathematics. Now, these works are too exhaustive to get into in depth, and just like I'm not a great philosopher, I'm also not a good enough mathematician to really do them justice. So I'm just going to do a rundown of the greatest hits. The big picture is that Omar Khayyam's work in many ways unified geometry and algebra for the first time and thus advanced both fields. He provided a commentary and proof of Euclid's postulate on parallels that can be considered the beginning of non-Euclidean geometry and provided a number of theorems, including those regarding what are now called Khayyam-Sacheri quadrilaterals. He also began the first systematic study of cubic equations and provided the first general solutions to cubic equations and proofs of several of Euclid's and Apollonius's postulates in that field. His commentaries on Euclid also contain the first attempts to grapple with irrational numbers, and most historians of mathematics believe that one of his missing works must contain the first general binomial theorem, based on his ability to extract roots. As a historian, what I find most interesting about this mathematical work is both that he was working off of the ancient Greek mathematics, as well as ancient Indian mathematics and earlier Abbasid mathematics, that his work drew from across the world, and then advanced the study of mathematics forward. And the advances he made would be relied upon by mathematicians across the world for centuries to come. But of course, today Omar Khayyam is more famous as a poet. Over the course of his life, when he wasn't occupied with mathematics and astronomy, Omar Khayyam wrote a total of somewhere between 1,200 and 2,000 quatrains. That is four-line poems. Mostly, these were written in Persian, with a smattering of Arabic language poems in the mix. These poems were scattered around in various collections, the authenticity of some of which are actually quite dubious. Eventually, they were collected in the 18th century by the English poet and author Edward Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald loosely translated them into English and published them as the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. Though initially commercially unsuccessful, the Rubaiyat eventually became a huge hit in America and in Europe, and Omar Khayyam clubs were set up to read and study the poetry of the long-dead Persian mathematician. But that said, modern scholars of Persian poetry believe that a large percentage, maybe even the majority of the quatrains contained in the Rubaiyat, were not actually written by Omar Khayyam. Those quatrains that we can say with a high degree of certainty were written by Omar Khayyam reveal a very complicated man. In some ways, a man of both pessimism and deep skepticism. Fittingly, Omar Khayyam appears to be a man thoroughly informed by the scientific method and the power of reason, with a deep distrust and skepticism towards organized religion, and he seems to be constantly let down by the inability of his fellow men to understand the world as he does. In one famous quatrain, Khayyam writes, "And that inverted bowl we call the sky, where under crawling cooped we live and die, lift not thy hands to it to help, for it rolls impotently as you or I." So a poem basically saying God is impotent and that prayer is worthless. But at the same time, there is far more to Khayyam than that, and people who claim that he was an atheist seem to be missing the complexities of his work. Khayyam's poetry often draws on mystical Sufi understandings of Islam and widely uses Sufi imagery. For example, in one quatrain he writes, "There was a door to which I found no key. There was a veil past which I could not see. Some little talk a while of me and thee, there seemed and then no talk of thee and me." This not only uses Sufi imagery, but is a presentation of the Sufi view of Islam, the inability of humans to truly grasp the greatness and unity of Allah and His creation, and the eventual mystical joining of the self to that creation. All in all, Omar Khayyam's poetry reveals a complicated and conflicted person. A deeply spiritual man, a Sufi, or at least a man deeply influenced by Sufism, but an intelligent and rational man, profoundly skeptical of orthodox Islamic practices, unimpressed by religious scholars, and distrustful of organized religion in general. Omar Khayyam eventually fell from favor at the Seljuk court following the death of Melik Shah and the end of al-Dawla al-Nizamiya. As the civil war erupted and Terkan Khatun set herself up in Esfahan, Omar Khayyam left the city to go on Hajj to Mecca, perhaps using this as an excuse to leave the war zone that Iran had become. Later, the Seljuk Sultan Sanjar invited him to return to Khorasan, and he served as a court astrologer to the Sultan in his later years. Eventually, as his health failed him, he was granted permission at some point in the late 1120s to return to his hometown of Nishapur to die. He lived the remainder of his life as a recluse in Nishapur, ultimately dying in 1131 at the age of 83. His work as a mathematician, astronomer, and poet would outlive him, of course, and continues to shape our world into the present day. Omar Khayyam's work in mathematics and astronomy were heavily relied on not only by scientists of the European Renaissance, but well into the modern era. And his poetry is still widely read and beloved today. In tattoo form, it even adorns the skin of some of our most annoying influencers and celebrities, in addition to sitting on the shelves of our most learned scholars. Indeed, he and his work may well be the most important cultural legacy of the great Seljuk Empire. So that ends our episode on culture in the great Seljuk Empire, as well as this run of non-narrative episodes. So next time, we will return to the narrative, picking up after the Battle of Manzikert to discuss the initial migrations of the Turks to Anatolia, and the establishment of the Seljuk Sultanate of Rum.